From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Recent investigations into the deaths of prisoners by the Miami Herald have brought public attention and scrutiny into the treatment of inmates in Florida's correctional facilities. Four State Department of Corrections investigators have recently filed a federal whistleblower lawsuit. The State Department of Law Enforcement is now investigating, and so far, one prison warden has been fired. We'll explore conditions and cultures within Florida's prison system and improvements that can be made going forward. Plus, this week marks the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Charley's destruction to southwest Florida. We'll explore how the hurricane impacted utility providers and emergency planners in Charlotte County, where Charley hit as a powerful Category 4 hurricane, as well as the environmental impacts of hurricanes. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. As today marks the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Charley hitting southwest Florida, we'll be taking a look at what emergency planners and utility providers in Charlotte County learned from the storm, along with the impacts of hurricanes, both positive and negative, to wildlife and the environment. That conversation's in the second half of the show. But first, recent investigative reporting by the Miami Herald into abuse, torture, and death of inmates in Florida prisons has raised public concern regarding the treatment of inmates and cultures within correctional institutions in the state. Those cases include the death of Dade Correctional Institution inmate Darren Rainey, who was confined to a scalding hot shower until he collapsed and died, along with the death of Franklin Correctional Facility inmate Randall Jordan Aparo, who died after being placed in solitary confinement and gassed several times by guards while requesting medical treatment for a worsening health condition. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement has begun investigating. Four Florida Department of Corrections investigators have filed a federal whistleblower complaint, and one warden so far has been fired. We'll explore conditions within Florida's prison system and what improvements can be made going forward. Joining me now is licensed mental health counselor George Malincrot. He formerly worked at a Dade Correctional Institution where Darren Rainey was killed and now has his own psychotherapy practice in Miami. Malincrot's efforts to shed light on the abuse of mentally ill prisoners prompted him to publish his own account. George, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's great to be on today.
We're also speaking with the chairman of the Project on Accountable Justice at Florida State University, Allison DeFore. DeFore is a man who wears many hats, including attorney, professor, and Episcopal priest. He served in the state attorney's office in the Florida Keys as a Monroe County Circuit Court judge, former running mate to Governor Bob Martinez, and served in the administrations of Governors Jeb Bush, Charlie Crist, and Rick Scott. Allison DeFore, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi, and don't forget, I was sheriff of Monroe County.
Oh, so, yes, of course, of course.
Sorry. Thanks for having me, John.
Thanks. And from Tallahassee, we're talking with Angela Robertson. Her brother, Collier County resident Justin Campos, was serving time in the Madison Correctional Institution, where he was murdered at the age of 28. The Campos family is still fighting for information from the Department of Corrections regarding the circumstances of his death. Angela, thanks for being with us.
It's Angelica. Thank you.
And we also invited the Florida Department of Corrections to join us today, but they were unable to provide a representative to join our conversation, as the inmate deaths we're discussing are still under investigation. Listeners can join our conversation. How should Florida address the deaths of inmates in our prison system? Call 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org, post comments and questions on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And George, let's start with you. Take us back to your days working in the psychiatric division at the Dade Correctional Institution. First of all, when did you work there?
I worked there for nearly 3 years, and I was fired August 31st, 2011. At the end of my tenure, an inmate named Joseph Swilling was beaten, and I tried to raise awareness of that. I even spoke to Jerry Cummings, the warden, and really nothing happened. So it's no surprise that Cummings was fired. Senior staffers knew about it, senior psychologists, and there was actually an eyewitness to the beating, but it was essentially covered up. By DOC rule, we are supposed to come forward and report inmate abuse. I was the only one who seemed to be concerned about it. And in fact, in a morning meeting, I brought up the issue and I was met with dead silence. I was tasked by Warden Cummings to do incident reports as I heard of abuse from the inmates in the unit. And so I was starting to really pump out these reports on a regular basis when I was fired.
So what reason did they give you for your termination, or did you leave of your own volition?
Actually, the work environment became very hostile for me. The guards, once their names appeared on the reports, started giving me, you know, bad looks. And an inmate of mine whose progress was sabotaged by guards actually attacked me. So my response was to take longer lunches, and that's why I was fired. I just couldn't really stand being in the place anymore. So to survive, I tried to stay out for lunch as long as possible.
It sounds like the Swilling case is, perhaps the most prominent one that you witnessed. But as you counseled inmates there, did you hear other stories?
Oh, sure. Stories from around the state. I heard about prisons up north where the beatdown was a common occurrence. And at first I took it with a grain of salt, but then when Swilling was beaten in my own unit, I thought, wait a second, maybe these guys were telling the truth, because, you know, we're coached to think that inmates lie. But the thing is, they tell the truth, too, and I believe that they had all witnessed or been the subject of inmate abuse of one kind or another.
And, you know, what about some of the other staff who were working with you in a mental health capacity? Did they share your concerns, or was there primarily just a culture there where you didn't talk about those things?
Well, yeah, there was a culture of silence, but there's a reason for that, because if guards took exception to you, they would leave you in an interview room with dangerous inmates, violent inmates. They'd leave you there alone. And that happened to a counselor who was a woman, and she resigned. So the message was, you speak out, you speak up, they're going to leave you and not protect you.
Wow. I had mentioned earlier that Department of Corrections investigators had filed a federal whistleblower lawsuit alleging widespread corruption, brutality, sanctioned gang violence in Florida prisons, and that they themselves became targets of retaliation by DOC Inspector General Jeffrey Beasley when they tried to bring these issues to light. Have you met with any of these investigators, and what can you tell us about the nature of their work?
No, I haven't met with these investigators, but I can tell you there's some really good people working for the DOC, and I did meet a former senior prison inspector by the name of Gary York. He wrote a book called Corruption Behind Bars that details some of the investigations that he did over the 12 years he was there at the Florida DOC. Cruz has said, oh, there's a few bad apples. Well, I happen to think it's more than a few, and I don't know how we can weed out these people, because the culture of abuse is so pervasive and widespread throughout Florida, as the stories of from the Miami Herald have indicated.
And, you know, I imagine that after leaving Dade Correctional Facility, these instances must have still haunted you, because you continued to try to really bring these issues to light. Tell us about those efforts.
Absolutely. 10 months after I was fired, I answer the phone with a typical hello, and it's my coworker, and she says, they killed him. And that was Darren Rainey. Rainey. So I could not stay silent in prison, and so I couldn't stay silent outside of prison. And about a month after Rainey was killed, I met with FBI agents, and I said, at some point I said, isn't the fact that guards scalded an inmate to death a good reason to open a case? They passed on it. I was so frustrated that I started writing a book that I called Getting Away with Murder, because it seemed like they really were.
And that book just recently published, correct?
Yes, it's actually been published for about 4 days. The paper book, the paperback version, can be found on CreateSpace. And then the ebook and Kindle version, I just put up today on smashwords.com. And if you do a search on either of those sites, Getting Away with Murder, you should be able to find it.
Join our conversation about the treatment of inmates in Florida's prisons. We're talking with former Miami Correctional Institution mental health counselor George Mallinckrodt, along with the chair of the Project for Accountable Justice at FSU, Allison DeFore. We're also talking with Angelica Robertson, whose brother Justin Campos was killed in the Tallahassee area correctional facility. You can connect with our guests by calling 877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Join our live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live, or post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Angelica, let's hear from you now. Your brother Justin Campos was killed in the Madison Correctional Institution near Tallahassee last fall. Can you describe your family's experience in regards to getting information about the circumstances of Justin's murder? Angelica, we've got a pretty poor phone line here, so we're going to call you right back, okay, and get more from your stories. Sorry about that, and we'll come right back to you. In the meantime, I want to turn to Allison. And we'll find out more about the Justin Campos case in just a minute here, but that investigation into his death has been going on for 11 months now. Darren Rainey, again, who was confined to that scalding hot shower, his death was 2 years ago. Is it typical for these kinds of investigations to really take a long time when it comes to finding out about the death of an inmate?
Well, an investigation can take a long time. That is a significant long time, I'll grant you that, but rather than second-guess the investigation, I guess we should probably await the results.
Sure.
If we step back a little bit from the anecdotal conversation, that's where we would want to go from our perspective. It's not hard to get anecdotal evidence of bad circumstances from a 100,000-person population of people who, you know, by definition includes some rough characters.
Mm-hmm.
So I've actually run a jail in Key West that was fairly sizable, and you don't have to look far to see difficult circumstances. But the real question is, how are you going to measure performance overall? And that'll lead you in the direction of culture change ultimately. And there probably needs to be some broad looks at cultural change, because the evidence is that the problem here is pretty way bigger than any one or two incidences. We're sitting on 5% of the world's population in the United States, and we've got 25% of the world's prisoners. That's pretty big. We're sitting on an incarceration rate of 719 per 100,000. Most of the civilized world, the Western world, is down around 100. Even the uncivilized world, you're looking at in the 500s. I mean, you're looking at like Russia and Iran and Cuba, significantly lower. We're the highest incarceration rate in the world. So of course, in Florida, one out of seven state employees is a Department of Corrections employee. So we have plenty of reason to pay attention with a $2 billion budget. It's one of the major components of the state's budget, and it's one that has been reined in as much as perhaps it hasn't been supervised as much as it needs to be. Where we think this is going to go is, at the end of the day, kind of in the direction that hospitals and schools have gone over the last 30 years. 30 years ago, if you'd have gone to a hospital administrator or a high school principal and said, "Show me your results," they'd have said, "Show me your subpoena or get off my property."
Mm-hmm.
And now you can talk all day long about what will be tested, but something will be tested in high schools, and something results in hospitals will become public, and they actually now compete with this information, and the public has a much higher level of involvement and engagement with those establishments. And the justice system has been the last really major area of government to undergo that kind of supervision from the broader public they serve. And right now, if you went to the courthouse and started buttonholing judges and prosecutors about performance, and certainly the Department of Corrections is reluctant in these areas, they act like you're in getting into their turf as opposed to them, you know, working for you and spending your money. So it'll be an interesting transition, but it most assuredly is coming. And that's what we're at Florida State at the Project on Accountable Justice. We're in consortium with Baylor and St. Pete College and Tallahassee Community College, and this is the area that we are working in every day.
And, you know, tell us about maybe what might have gone on as far as Governor Rick Scott's administration or the state legislature in terms of, you know, taking steps to make the Department of Corrections oversight more independent.
Well, one of the things we think is going to be imperative is the idea of some sort of oversight board. Every community college in the state has got a board that comes in every month and kind of looks over what they're doing, and this system doesn't have anything close to that. And in fact, to the contrary, we've had six secretaries in the last 6 years. I'm sorry, 8 years, in the last 8 years of the Department of Corrections, and it's very difficult to have any kind of oversight at all under those circumstances, frankly, meaningful oversight. So trying to get a beast of this size managed is a hard job, and it's a harder job without some sort of continuity. And we believe strongly that some sort of supervisory board would do that on a month-to-month basis. I was on the board of the community college here in Tallahassee, and, you know, people who know that they're being overseen just behave differently. That's just the way it is. And even the janitor at the college knew that if things were really bad, they could drop a quarter in a payphone and call one of the trustees and bring it to light. So it just was, you get a different cultural reaction when people are being overseen.
And so basically it sounds like you're saying this is kind of a systemic problem in regards to just having a lack of outside accountability.
We've got to wait and see what the investigation reveals, but clearly a culture that would, if anything close to the allegation of parboiling of a prisoner occurred, this is America. We don't do that. Mm. And so something it would be clearly amiss if that, any culture that would permit that is in need of significant reform.
Well, we're exploring the treatment of inmates in Florida's prison system following recent reports from the Miami Herald, which have uncovered corruption, abuse, torture, and death of inmates allegations. We're speaking with Angelica Robertson, whose family is fighting for the release of information regarding the death of her brother in a Florida prison. We're also speaking with psychotherapist and whistleblower Gary Mallinckrodt and Allison DeFore of the Project for Accountable Justice at Florida State University. You can connect with our guests by calling 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or join our live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Angelica, now we've got you back. I wanted to come back and hear a bit about your story and your family's struggles just trying to get information about the circumstances of Justin's death.
We've reached out. We don't receive calls back. We've tried emails. We don't receive anything. The only answer we've gotten is it's a pending investigation, which can be frustrating because it's almost been a year, and, you know, we're just waiting and waiting. And I just feel like at this point, you know, something should be said to us before the public finds out, being that we're the family, and, you know, how long should it actually take to receive some kind of feedback or response from them.
And Justin was in prison for the shootings of two men who it turned out were members of the notorious Latin Kings gang. Did that fact put him at greater risk for harm from other inmates?
Oh, we believe so. Initially, before his death, he had been attacked, and once they moved him, 3 weeks later, he was murdered. So we do feel like it was an isolated incident that was targeted towards him, and we just felt like there was definitely a neglect in protecting him. And we do know that he signed a waiver, but, you know, a few days later after he signed it is when he realized, you know, this was definitely geared towards him, what was going on.
So based on what Justin told you or your mother, other members of your family, he had requested some sort of protective custody?
Yes, he did. And then he said he had already signed his waiver, so he didn't know what to do at that point. Me and my mom visited him a few times in between the transition and had those conversations. And, you know, it was new for us, so
right.
You know, we didn't know where to begin.
And, you know, you're in Tallahassee, not far from where the Madison Correctional Institution is, where Justin was. Whenever you visited him, did he ever give you any indication that he felt that he was in danger?
Not at all. He didn't. He was always a pretty strong individual. He knew something was up, and he kept his guard. We just told him, you know, try to keep a routine, keep to yourself. If you see anything, you know, feel free to protect yourself, because at this point, you're fighting for your life. And we just didn't realize how soon, you know, his life would end after we had those conversations.
And I understand your family has received conflicting information regarding the circumstances of his death.
Yes, we've spoken to a few officials when it did initially happen. And they've changed the story on where it happened a few times. And after that, a few months later, then they kind of just complete all information that they were sharing with us just stopped. They just said, you know, it's under investigation and we can't share anything with you.
What would knowing the details regarding Justin's death mean for you and your family?
For us, we just want individuals to be held accountable. We want justice. You know, we're angry, we're upset, but we also are aware, you know, there's other people out there that don't have a voice. And I think, you know, everybody doesn't have the resources, and we want people to know that, you know, these are human lives that are being lost and hurt and being abused, and it shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen in the United States of America.
And Allison and Gary, the defining characteristic of the inmate demographic is that these are all men and women who have been convicted of some sort of crime. Does that fact itself make it more difficult, do you think, to garner public support for efforts to make sure inmates are protected or to convince lawmakers to take up the cause?
Yeah, well, that's George, by the way.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. Did I not call you George? I apologize.
Yeah, I think that does make a difference. Because basically inmates are not believed. And one of the things that Julie Brown said in her first story, she mentioned the Scully death and so on and so forth. And I've read stories like that before, and they go nowhere. And she did give me credit for coming forward publicly to put a professional name on the story, as opposed to, oh, it's just another inmate, they lie, who's going to believe him, they're mentally ill, and so on and so forth. But, you know, it's out now. The DOC has huge problems, and there's a greater public awareness that something has to be done. In fact, there's been a petition calling for the Justice Department and Eric Holder to get involved in the murder investigation of Darren Rainey. It's got over 150,000 signatures from people worldwide. This is becoming a big issue.
Well, we found that the business community in Florida has actually been quite interested in this because of the cost factor. At the end of the day, there are plenty of unsavory things that get managed in government, and I don't think we can cross the line into... I was part of the group that helped clean up Key West from drug smuggling. You can't just say, well, that's just Key West. We're going to let it be run by the smugglers. I mean, you end up with New Orleans if you go down that road. Mm. The business community cares here in Florida about this because of the tax and fiscal implications. This is a huge portion of our budget, and we don't have the right to burn the taxpayers' money on things that don't work or that work less efficiently. There are ways to do this. Other states are doing it and are dropping their populations significantly and dropping their crime rate faster than Florida while they do it.
That's a great point, Allison. I think it costs a lot less to house the mentally ill in community centers as opposed to putting them in prison.
Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the show. We've been speaking with Allison Dufour, George Mallinckrodt, and Angelica Robertson. Thank you so much for being with us today, all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's
great.
Bye-bye.
Allison Dufour is chair of the Project for Accountable Justice at FSU. George Mallinckrodt is a practicing mental health counselor and former psychotherapist with the Dade Correctional Institution. And Angelica Robertson is the sister of Immokalee resident Justin Campos, who was killed last year in a state correctional facility. We're taking a short break, but when we return, today marks the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Charley making landfall in southwest Florida as a powerful Category 4 storm. We'll take a look back at that day, exploring what utility providers and emergency planners learned from the storm, as well as how Charlie impacted wildlife and the environment. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.